Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Well, the reason, for the benefit of those people who actually like to check out our Facebook photographs and various other factors, that I've decided to go for the New York Real Talk backdrop is quite eminently due to our guest for the Author of the Week. Of course, native New Yorker from the South Bronx, indeed the South Bronx Fort Apache region. We're delighted to welcome ace author James L. Hill to the program. How are you, James?
Hey, everybody. I'm fine. I'm good.
Excellent. Well, it's great to connect with your good self. And as I say, we do a weekly show called New York Real Talk. So I think it was only right, really, given your New York background, that we kind of keep the sort of thing going on that system, really, which is great stuff.
Know. And you know, once a New Yorker, always a New Yorker.
So I believe, exactly. So it's key from that point of view. Now, you've had a fascinating career so far, and it's obviously just working through that. You've got a degree in computer programming. You're a multi-genre author. And indeed, you've also started your own publishing house, which is Rock Hill Publishing, LLC, which is great. But before we get into all of that, let's talk about your adult urban crime series, The Killer series, not to be confused, of course, with Brandon Flowers' band The Killers, but this is The Killer singular series.
Right. Well, The Killer series, I just wrapped up last year, with the fourth book, Killer with Ice Eyes. And it followed the story of two guys, Mojo Johnson, who comes out of the South Bronx, and Nicky Nails, who is a mobster from the North Bronx. Well, the Bronx had broken up into different sections. So he's more of a North type of area, more Italian, Irish neighborhood. And so they get together as teenagers and they raise hell, to put it lightly. They raise hell in the underworld.
And, you know, that's clear to the whole sort of part of the whole thing. Now, New York, obviously, people associated with so good they named it Price, where they named the city twice. I can never get the words out, basically. But it's got a kind of romance, clearly, from our point of view. And as you said at the start, that New York itself has got a whole range of historical aspects within that. So was this something that you kind of drew on your own experiences to actually develop this? Or was it a case of, no, I took it all from the movie Fort Apache, the Bronx?
No, it's actually a lot of it comes from my own experience and from people I knew and grew up with. I tell people I knew quite a few people in the mob when I grew up because I moved from the South Bronx into a mob neighborhood. So I kind of like had friends who were in the mob and on their way to being in the mob. And so I knew quite a few people. So, and being in New York, we have a saying, you hang out with those you meet. In other words, whatever neighborhood you live in, those are going to be your friends. They're either going to be your friends or your enemies. So you kind of hang out with those who you meet. And therefore, you get to know these people. So when I was in the South Bronx, I grew up in a time when gangs were prevalent and you needed a gang to go to the store. You needed people with you. You know, you didn't walk alone. And so we moved out of that neighborhood and moved into a mob neighborhood. And therefore, I wound up knowing people who were in the mob. And the stories are all fiction, of course, because I don't want to wind up in the unmarked grave in Jersey somewhere. So, or in witness protection, you know, you don't want to be, you know, living out in Kansas, unless you happen to like Kansas. But but anyway, so the stories are made up, but they're based or they're influenced by people I met, people I know, things that you hear and that things that you have seen. So even though my ex-wife now, when she read the first book, she was like, yeah, this is a factual. This is not a fiction. This is a faction. You know, her being from the Bronx also, she recognized some of the things that were in the book as being, yeah, this could be true. I'm pretty sure you didn't do this, but this could have happened. I know some people who might have had that inkling or done that type of thing. So it's that kind of a story. it will ring very true to people who read it. I have a lot of my friends in New York who read the book, and they tell me, "Wow, you captured the neighborhood. Wow, you really got the flavor of you know, New York in this."
Do you look back with a kind of nostalgia? I mean, because obviously there are many people who say, well, it's a lot better now. We don't actually have all those challenges with respect to drive-by shootings and muggings. Mind you, having said that, you just go to school in America, it seems, you get those sort of issues, but that's another thing entirely. But, you know, is that, do you write with a form of nostalgia there, or is it just a case of actually it's kind of, you know, a Robin Hood-esque way? It's a romanticization, or is it just a case of, well, it's a story?
I think all writers have a bit of nostalgia when they're writing. They're pulling from parts of their memories and parts of their life that while you're living it, and this is going with a lot of people, not just writers, but when you're living through something, you don't have the how would you say it, the beauty of being able to look at it from the outside, you know, the subjective view of what you're going through. So after you moved on from that period in your life, you're able to look back on it and you're able to glean some information from that period of your life that you romanticize and say, well, this is better than what it actually was. Because if you think about it hard enough, you're like, hey, yeah, that part of my life wasn't really good. When people ask, would you go back and relive that? And you're like, well, maybe not, because I was lucky to get out of there alive. So maybe I wouldn't go back and relive that. But thinking about it, you sort of like pick out the better parts of your life. And you pick out the better things that happened. And you tend to forget the worst things that have happened to you. Same thing when you talk about school. When people write about school, they always write about the really good teacher they had and the really bad teacher they had. The ones that fall in the middle don't get remembered. You remember the really good one that boosted you up, and you remember the really bad one that you hated and wish you could have killed when you had them as, you know, your English teacher.
So clearly no place for mediocrity. Well, we can go with that. That's fine. Yes. I mean, again, I must admit, as a youngster, I remember, I think, my first experience, or my media experience, shall we say, of New York was through the Roger Moore incarnation of James Bond in Live and Let Die. With Mr. Big and various other sort of characters within that. I mean, was that something which, again, was just, well, what do you expect when you got British writer like Ian Fleming putting this together?
Oh, I love James Bond. That's one of my, you know, and of course, I go back all the way to the Sean Connery James Bond when I was a kid and everything. And I had my James Bond attaché case. And, you know, so I grew up on those type of movies, the James Bonds and all that kind of stuff. And part of the killer series have that flavor to it of not so much like you see today in the John Wick movies or something like that, where it's all this gunplay and, you know, outrageous stuff, but more of that subtle idea of plot twist and storyline, and this is coming, and then you don't see that part coming and all that kind of stuff. So it's more innuendos and more not outright violence. Well, let me take that back. There is a lot of outright violence. When you talk about the mob and things like that in gang, there is some outright violence right there. But it's more in line with your plot rather than just, I'm running through the street shooting everything I see. You know, it's not that type of a story. Sure. It's more of a James Bondish type story where there's these overarching themes and moralities and things like that are exposed through the violence and sex and the era of the time.
Well, as I say, it's a four-part crime series: Killer with a Heart, Killer with Three Heads, Killer with Black Blood, and of course, Killer with Ice Eyes. The final chapter, of course, of The Boys from the Bronx, available now. Why computer programming, out of interest? Because you've got a degree in computer programming, which is obviously very commendable and key from that. But why computer programming as opposed to forensic science?
Well, because, let me tell you how I actually got into it and then what the lore is for me. Because I've always been a writer. I've been a writer since I was a little kid, and I like creating stories and I like creating ideas. I like the idea of being able to create something from nothing. So how I got into computer programming was my mom worked in a bank, and this is going way back to when we had checks and everything, and check sorting.
I still use checks. I still once or twice, I still actually use them, so they haven't quite gone. Thank the Lord.
In my business, I still have to use checks as a publisher, because sometimes it's just easier to write my authors a check than it is to, you know, go through electronic payments and stuff. So, but people who are local or in the United States, I can mail them a check, and it's easier for me than to have to pay the electronic fees and all that kind of stuff. But going back to the idea of check processing, which I wound up doing also, I wound up in my mom's old division. She was working on a sort program. So she was working on how do we sort the check? Because when, especially in New York, you get checks from everywhere. And then they had to be sorted and sent out to what we call the FRB, the Federal Reserve Banks. And so they get sorted and they go to different areas, and then they get processed. And part of that process is the amount of money that the banks deposit into the FRB, they get interest on. And it's all time related. You know, you want your local banks, your local checks to go in earlier than you want your California banks, let's say. They can go at midnight because they're not going to get there till tomorrow or something like that anyway. But you want to get as much money into the local FRB as possible so you can get that interest, the most interest you can. And so I sat there and I've seen her, you know, try to figure this out. And I said, well, you know, we were big in playing cards at that time. I said, hey, we should set this up as a card game, you know. And so and that's what really got me into computers. And then in high school, I started learning BASIC. And I went to a Catholic high school, private school, private system. And they were one of the first ones to come in with an actual computer programming course. So I could either take calculus or I could take computer programming. And once I got into computer programming, I was hooked. I learned all the bad things you could do with computers. I was one of the first ones to write a denial of service attack across my Catholic high school network. You know.
So you're an early computer hacker is what you're basically saying.
Yeah. You find out all the good and bad things you can do and the fun that you can have. Like I'm writing games and everything, and I'm put out this program, hey, and this is on paper tape. So you have these long paper tapes and everything. And you come up with these ideas of what can I do? What can I make this machine do? And, you know, and that became interesting to me. And it's just another form of writing. So as I got on with it, it was another form of writing. Somebody would come up with an idea and say, hey, I need the computer. I need you to write me a program that will do this. Or you come up with an idea. You know what's a good idea? I think I want to do this with this computer. And so then you have to work out how to do it. You know, the plot, the storyline, the theme that you want to create. So it's all a form of creation and writing. And so it just stuck with me. I kind of love it.
I'm intrigued in terms of the way in which you thought about the process of writing, etc. And I'm going to put this to you because obviously you're sufficiently chronologically gifted, like myself, to actually remember the times where before we had keyboards to actually type all our stuff on and all the rest of bits and pieces, we had typewriters, and some of those were electric, and some of those were, and even we had actually had pen, etc. Do you ever have any nostalgic terms to actually go back to those days, or is it a case of no? I did my degree in computer programming, and I stick with a computer. All of my novels are done on a laptop or a computer.
Well, partially. I do write stuff longhand with pen and paper sometimes. I do most of my stuff on computer, on laptop and things. But then when I get into sort of like a mood where I'm in, where you're in a zone and you know, okay, I need to write this part and it's going, and the ideas are going to come quickly. I'm a horrible typist, I'll tell you right now. I'm glad for computer because I can correct my errors. When you're typing things on paper, yeah, it's not going to correct it. I'm also
that's what TippX is for, surely.
Yeah. I also have a horrible handwriting. So, you know, if I write something out, I need to immediately transcribe that into a computer because if I wait a couple of days, I may not be able to read what I wrote. I have notebooks over here. I got, you know, volumes of notebooks and stuff where I'll sit down and I'll write stuff into the notebook. Because when it comes to a part of a story that I'm working on, and I got this idea and I'm like, okay, I got to get this out because, you know, it'll shift and change with time. So you got to really get your ideas down at the time. And I don't type fast enough to get all of my ideas out through the computer. So I'll sit down and I'll write longhand and write the dialogue and write the scenes and everything, a couple of pages worth of scenes and dialogue and stuff longhand. And then I'll transcribe that into the story in the computer. And sometimes I'll write it and I'll just put a thing in, go to notebook, and then skip down and then start writing more of the story in the on the computer, because I know, okay, so that part is going to come from the notebook. And the rest of the story, as I'm building the story, it's not this emotional type of drain that's coming out of me that I have to get down right now. Because I know I'm going to go back and rework these parts of the story. You know, it's just the idea of getting the story flow or getting the idea down. And I'm going to rework that part. I know that. It's not exactly how I want it. But this other part is something that pretty much I'm going to put in there word for word as I'm thinking of it now. You know, it's got that kind of spark to it that you have to get down as is. And I might rework that too. When I read it over, it's like, oh, crap. You know, this is really bad English. I got to fix this up. I got to dress this up a bit. But so I work in both medium, paper and pen and computer. I don't work with typewriters anymore because first off, they're heavy and hard to carry around. I did travel with a typewriter at one point, you know, big old, I think with the Olivera, big, heavy monster, you know. So.
Yeah, it was good to build up the muscles, if nothing else, from that point of view. But yeah. There we go. Of course, one of the advantages of the technological age that we actually are enjoying and so on is the opportunity to obviously set up your own publishing side of things. And you started Rock Hill Publishing LLC, primarily, I think, to publish your own work, but also to open up this. So, again, was that a dream that you actually had that you thought, well, you know, I've got good stuff here. Lots of sort of stuff is worthwhile. Let's get it out of there.
Partially because as you try to get yourself published and there's all the different obstacles to get through, you have to get an agent. You have, you know, you think, okay, I can just go directly to a publisher and present my work. And they say, no, you need to go to an agent. We don't take anything that's not agented. And then you say, okay, well, let me go find an agent. And agents are like, no, well, we don't take anything but this, or we don't take anything but that. And so it's all these obstacles that are put in the way of people. And because of my computer background, I did a lot of word processing and Word documents and all that kind of stuff working on in that field. And I was like, you know, it's not really that hard to put together a book. It's not really that hard to get these things published. So I learned what you actually needed to do to actually put together a book, to publish your own work. And I found out I was able to cut through all that and publish my own stuff. You need an editor, you know, you need second eyes. As a computer programmer, we have a thing called peer review. No matter how good you think your computer program is, you better run that through somebody else's vision and let them find the mistakes that you don't see. Because you know what's in your head and you know what you want your programs to do. And then someone else is going to throw the monkey wrenches in that you didn't think of or that you didn't plan for. And so when you're writing, you know your story and you know what's in your head, but is it what you put on paper? You know, are the plot holes sufficiently filled in? You know, is someone going to read your work and say, hey, what happened to, you know, what happened to Johnny? He was here in the first three chapters and disappeared. He went off to the library and never came back. Is he still in the library? You know, this is 3 months later now. We don't hear nothing.
Well, he might be a heavy reader. He might be working his way through the whole sort of series of books there. He could well be in the library.
Or he might be dead. We got to know. Did he ever actually get to the library? You know, he said he was going to the library and that was the last we ever heard of him. So, you know, that plot holes and things like that that you might not think of. It's like, well, he was just a minor character. All right. Well, if he was a minor character, you still got to tell me what happened to him, you know,
Yeah,
and
because
things like that. So you need other eyes on your work. And then the technical part of publishing is not all that hard. It is hard. There's formatting to go through, there's book designs, and there's all kinds of stuff that goes into publishing a book. And some of it I can do because of my technical background, and some of it I hire out to other people. I have a graphic artist who does some of my book covers. You know, I met her in San Diego when I was out in San Diego. And I like to work with new people, people new to the business. I like to give them the start that I had. Like I said, I went through sending information out to publishers. I took a paper job so that I could go and slide my work underneath all these editors and all these magazine offices down in Manhattan. You know, I took a job delivering a newspaper 4 o'clock in the morning, so I would have access to all these publishing houses and all these magazine things, so I could slide my work in there with their paper. Didn't amount to anything, but it was a good idea on how to get there.
Absolutely. It certainly shows that initiative on which the city of New York was founded. So the
Yeah.
founding fathers would be delighted to see that still put into place, which is great stuff. Let's talk music, James, because many authors, when we speak to them, have got a, I mean, they either have one or two things. They either prefer to write in silence, or they just like to listen to music without lyrics, or they have their own personalized playlist that they effectively like to put together whilst they're actually writing. Do you have any particular influences which you think, yep, when I'm writing, I don't know, this particular genre, I always like to go for that?
Well, I'm a heavy rock and roll fan, and you'll like this because I also like a lot of British rock. I like the Pink Floyd, which is amazing to me because now people are discovering Pink Floyd 50 years later. And I see all these things on YouTube and everything. Well, Pink Floyd, they're great. And I'm like, yeah, they were great 50 years ago too. Of course, these people weren't born then, so they don't know. But, you know, but it depends on the type of writing that I'm doing. Sometimes I crank up the music, you know. Sometimes it's bad if it's too many lyrics because then you start singing and you stop writing. I also used to write with the TV playing because I would have the anime stuff going from like 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock or more because each one of these little shows are half an hour, and it's like okay, I need something to tell me when to stop writing and go to bed. Because, you know, still have a day job, you got to get up and go to bed and go to work. And I only need 3 or 4 hours worth of sleep, well, 4 or 5 hours now. But so I would have to make sure that 2 o'clock or maybe stretch it to 3 o'clock if I was really onto something. But at some point, you have to know to cut it off. So that helped. Knowing that I'm rolling an album, let's say, that's a half an hour. So if I'm just going to play some music behind it, then, you know, like I said, I have my favorites. I have my Rolling Stones. I have my Led Zeppelin, my Pink Floyd. I have Aerosmith. I have Jimi Hendrix, one of the best. I don't know if you can see, but Kiss is right behind me. There's a Led Zeppelin poster back there. There's the Emerald Lady behind me. You know, that's one of my books. But, you know, I'm heavily into rock and roll. So, yeah. And in the Killer series, some of those influences come into play because it gives people an idea of the time period. Like, and I think I'm talking about the Rolling Stones, Sticky Fingers when that first came out. So that for people who would know the story and know the time period, they will automatically say, oh, that's 1972 or something, you know, because that's when that album came out. If you're younger, you may not know exactly when that came out, but you know, okay, this story is taking place in the 70s because this is the rock and roll of that time, you know, that, you know, the Rolling Stones or Jimi Hendrix or somebody like
Okay, so next question I've got to ask you. Favorite Rolling Stones track?
that. I would say Sympathy for the Devil.
to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his face. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg when I saw it was a time for a change.
You're listening to our Author of the Week feature. It's the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. We've got fabulous James Hill. You just heard the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. Great track, great selection. We're speaking about the work that you've been doing, your multi-talented style of broadcasting and indeed publishing, etc. But let's move on to the multi-genre approach, because you're currently, James, working on a three-part historical fantasy gemstone series. So you alluded us to the image that you got behind you, again, visualization, so good for radio, the Emerald Lady that's in publication, the Ruby Cradle, of course, the Diamond Warrior coming soon from that point of view. This is a complete switch in some ways from your urban crime series, or is it? I mean, are you channeling your kind of inner George R.R. Martin and actually getting together some of the other shenanigans that go on with respect to fantasy and history?
Well, no, because I kind of like separate things by genre. So when I'm writing fantasy, it's kind of like pure fantasy work. So there's dragons and pirates in the first one.
So you wouldn't ever have a sort of mafia meeting in the streets of New York where they actually encounter an elf with a lance, though. That's not going to happen, is it?
No, that's not going to happen.
Okay.
It's kind of a historical type of thing, because I blend a little history in to the story. So the Emerald Lady takes place in the American Revolution, the 17th century type of thing, the golden age of pirates. The Ruby Cradle is going to take, it starts off with the Crimean War during that period, and then it rockets back into the age of castles. And the way it does that is that the mermaids live 1,000 years, and then they have telepathy. They have this mental connection that they can actually relive somebody else's life. They can join and relive their memories, even if the person is dead. So their history kind of like it carried on through generation after generation. And so the Bella winds up meeting up with her grandma from the first book and going back to live her great-grandmother's life in the age of castles, and what happened between the mermaids and the dragons, and why dragons are bad. In this storyline, dragons are the bad guys. You know, I like dragons. I might write a fantasy one day where dragons are good guys. But in this fantasy series, the dragons are the bad guys.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Anne McCaffrey would be most upset with the whole Dragon Rider series if you'd gone down that line of it not being great. And let's not get started on the works of Ursula K. Le Guin. But still, yeah. I suppose it's balance. That's the important thing. Are you, if pushed, would you say you're more of a fantasy SF appreciation person, or are you more kind of real crime? Or is it a case of you work with both?
Well, I work with all three. But I started off writing sci-fi. Hmm. And that's where I really like to write my stories, in sci-fi, because I really like to take a look at the world around me and project what happens. So Pegasus is the first sci-fi book that I wrote. And that's actually one of the first books that I did write, was Pegasus, A Journey to New Eden, which at the time I wrote it was like in the 70s or 80s. And I projected to the time of 2050s, 2057, when the book actually take place. So I looked ahead to what my grandchildren would be doing when they grew up and the world they will be living in. And I looked at some of the things that were going on then. So I predicted 3D printing, and I predicted space technologies, and the fall of the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union would collapse within, you know, a couple of years from its own under its own weight of trying to maintain this vast empire. It was going to wind up collapsing, and different things and really looking at how do people, and this is the thing about writing sci-fi, it's not only the technology and these, you know, robots or spaceships or these type of thing, but it's how do it affect you? How does this affect people? And how do people affect these things? Like, we went to the moon, and what did we get out of it? We got cell phones now. You look at Star Trek, you know, the reason why we have Bluetooth and things like that, because people watch Star Trek and said, that is cool. I am going to invent that. I will get that built, you know? And so when we see things that people write about in sci-fi, other people see that and say, hey, I can do that. Or people come up with these ideas and sci-fi writers say, well, what happens if it goes this way or that way, you know? And we project onto the future what some minor or some major development will be. Like right now, people are talking about making small, compact nuclear generators, right? Mainly the military. But they're thinking about making these small nuclear. That's going to be something that in the next 20 to 30 years is going to be dotted around the globe, you know, digging for, they're going to stop drilling for oil and start drilling for geothermic power, because you can do geothermic anywhere in the world. You just have to drill a well deep enough to hit the way the temperatures are really hot under, and it's something that will bring power anywhere in the world. Unlike, well, you know, you have nuclear power, there's going to be some problems there. You have this, you'll have this problem. When all these different types of things have both advantages and disadvantages to them. So you start looking at the world, we're going to have to get off oil. First off, oil is not going to last forever. It's all kinds of problems that we're dealing with. And sooner or later, people are going to have to realize these are the things that must happen. We must change this, you know. People went from steam power, where steam power was great, until they realized, oh, but there's a lot to contain in that thing. We need internal combustion, much easier to maintain. So now we're going to move from that into other type of energy production, because the world is so big, we need this energy and we need to get it from multiple places. And we also need to preserve our planet. And so when I wrote Pegasus, I was looking into the future and saying, well, what's going to happen? How is it going to happen? How is it going to affect people? And so that was the idea behind that.
The essence of our story is, again, a dystopian science fiction thriller from that point of view, which, again, we can also say, by the way, that not only did the moon landings give us the notion of the mobile phone, but arguably they also gave us nonstick frying pans, which is also fairly important, really, in terms of Teflon. But there we are. We featured the Rolling Stones earlier. We're going to wrap up in a few moments, but I need to ask you, do you have a favorite Pink Floyd number?
Yes, and it's more like a favorite Pink Floyd album. It's Wish You Was Here. And I named my boat after Pink Floyd. I named my boat Umagumma, after the album Umagumma. But I love Pink Floyd, Wish You Was Here. And back in the day, I just bought a brand new stereo system. And I bought the Pink, it came out the same time Pink Floyd came out. So I, you know, saved up all my hard-earned working money and everything. Got my stereo system. Pink Floyd, Wish You Was Here just came out. I'm putting it on. We're doing things, and friends and everybody's around. We're doing things. We're cranking the music up. You know, we're playing, you know, boom, 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 boom. It's going, it's going. We're cranking it up. We're cranking it up. I get to Wish You Was Here. And at the end of that movie, at the end of that music, that song, the sound cuts out. Whoosh, so low. And of course, I'm thinking, oh my God, I just blew my new stereo system. I just ruined my stereo, you know, and looking at everything, doing all this, putting the radio. Okay, everything else is working. I go back, I put the song again from the beginning, and it's playing wonderfully, and the sound drops out. I'm like, God damn it, Pink Floyd. Why would you do that?
Because they're being creative, James. That's the key thing. Yeah, the way they were.
Creative. Yeah. I sat down and wrote them a letter. I didn't know where to send it to, though, but I wrote them a letter saying, this is the worst thing that you could do with a song. Why? Why? Yeah. And you owe me. You owe me for, you know, a atmosphere.
Clearly, know, clearly.
The atmosphere that I just blew out the window.
we will raise that issue. And the listening, I'm sure we'll get that to AMI as well. James, it's been fantastic connecting with you, good self. There's so much more we could actually talk about and we'll do from that. But we've got two final questions to put to you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been okay for you?
It had been great. It's been a wonderful Zoom and really nice. And you're a great person to talk to, a great interviewer. So, Alex, I thank you very much.
Thank you, James. Well, the second thing is, and hopefully we'll get a positive this, will you be kind enough to join us on another one of our programs, maybe even New York Real Talk in the not-too-distant future? Will you come back and connect again with us?
Absolutely. Just let me know when and we'll arrange it and, you know, I will absolutely be there. You want to talk New York? I'm the guy. I will talk
Clearly.
To you about New York all day long. Yeah.
I think that's a whole area we need to explore and develop from that point of view, particularly I know as Pamela Suman, our musician from New York, would say, it's always nice to actually have New Yorkers talk about New York itself. Because I think she's from, she's a native of New York now, but she wasn't born there. So on that basis, you know, it's a different line. James, finally, how can people actually follow you on various social media? Or do you have a website or is there a way in which people can stay in touch with you, good self?
Well, people can get in touch with me through my publishing warehouse website, rockhillpublishing.com, all one word, rockhillpublishing.com. I also have Facebook, which you can look me up by James L. Hill or J.L. Hill, because I write under two different names. Adult crime novels are written under J.L. Hill, and everything else is written under James L. Hill. So you wouldn't want to pick up a J.L. Hill book unless you were ready for some really hardcore, you know.
I think the challenge is there, certainly. James L. Hill, also known as J.L. Hill, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on, and we will speak again very soon. Here's Pink Floyd. Thank you.
And discipline remains mercifully.
Yes, and neither would you, Derek, this star nonsense.
Yes.
No, it is it.
I'm sure of it.
Think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell? Leave.
Acupuncture Awareness Week, something you may not be aware of, but it is a national campaign launched by the British Acupuncture Council to highlight the benefits of traditional acupuncture. And to talk us through this, who better than the Research and Policy Manager at the British Acupuncture Council? That's the wonderful Ian Appleyard. How are you, Ian?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, acupuncture is something which I think over the years has gone from quirky eccentricity to, oh, it's something that they do in the Far East to actually deal with needles, etc., to an accepted part of actually seeing it as being an essential part of complementary therapy in general. I mean, is this something where, you know, clearly Acupuncture Awareness Week is still needed to actually ensure people do actually have an awareness of how it can actually help with difficulties with chronic pain, anxiety, depression, and other issues that affect our well-being?
I think there is still some awareness required, obviously. But you're right. I mean, we've gone, and the survey results sort of reflect the general trend that's been occurring really since it's landed on our shores in many ways in the 1970s. It's been gone from being sort of virtually illegal, it was illegal in America, to a sort of very much a sort of quirky, eccentric, sort of counterculture type thing to be doing, to gradually becoming more accepted, to early trials with quite small numbers, and then wider acceptance. And now we end up with some clinical trials that have got thousands of people in, and we have very strong evidence, especially for chronic pain. So meaning osteoarthritis of the knee, lower back pain, headaches, shoulder pain. But work needs to be done in other conditions, particularly sort of second rank, if you like, coming up. Things like mental health conditions. So there is quite good evidence for acupuncture for depression. And a very good trial was conducted in this country showing that acupuncture could well be a very useful part of the armory, as it were, to help people with depression. But if you're a purist scientist, you might want more information and more trials to be done. So we do need further research, but also to explain to people where we're at. So yes, chronic pain, pretty much well known and fairly well accepted, but other conditions, maybe allergic rhinitis, hay fever, things like that, which I believe acupuncture can also be useful for, and there is some evidence to suggest it's the case, people should know that that is also a possibility.
Were you surprised to find that nearly three quarters of us would actually prefer to try a complementary therapy like acupuncture before prescription painkillers? Because, again, certainly in the 20th century seemed to be a case of, oh, I'll just prescribe you some pills for that and it'll all be sorted.
Yes, well, it's again part of the general trend, along with acupuncture being better known, is that people understand that sometimes the medications have side effects. So, of course, there's a convenience to having a medication. You just take the pill and hopefully that's done and dusted. But if you do begin to get side effects and things like that, or it doesn't truly resolve the issue that you have, then you cast around for other alternatives. So I think there's a better perception within the general public that medications come with the side effects and may not be what they want to go down. Chronic pain, you may have heard of the opioid crisis, particularly in the United States, where people prescribed opioids and then they get addicted to them. So that's obviously something people would wish to avoid.
The importance of research can never really be underestimated, especially when it comes to the scientific method. Do you feel, Ian, that we are actually getting to the stage where the science is confirming what many practitioners of complementary or alternative therapies have been saying for years?
Yes, for some conditions, I would definitely say for chronic pain, there's extremely strong evidence, a systematic review of over 20,000 people, and all done not necessarily by pure acupuncturists like myself, but most of the clinical trials were run by the Charité in Germany, which is a very highly ranked sort of academic hospital institution. So it was done well. There are quite some details within that that still need to be ironed out. For me, they would generally mean that acupuncture is even more effective. We are also beginning to learn more and more about the biomechanisms. So all sorts of what are called peripheral effects, changes in the functional connectivity of the brain, in limbic structures and things, all which are potential mechanisms that show how acupuncture works. But it is very complicated, and I don't think we're going to have sort of acupuncture works because of X, Y, Z for quite some time. A lot more work does need to be done.
This is all about ensuring that we don't have too many blockages of the chi in terms of our health and so on. Where can people find out more information, Ian, about
They can come along to our website, which is acupuncture.org.uk, or just Google the British Acupuncture Council. So you can find information about acupuncturist or acupuncture. And one of the advantages of the British Acupuncture Council member is we are accredited by the Professional Standards Authority, which overviews what we do. So people can be more assured, can be assured that the practitioner is safe, well-trained, and has your interests at heart.
Which is obviously critical. I mean, clearly the notion of the British Acupuncture Council or BAC being good for your back could well be applied from that point of view, but that's another line entirely. But just very briefly, to wrap up with, what attracted you to acupuncture in the first place? What led you to take up the practice?
It was an interest. In terms of Chinese philosophy, you would say yuan fen is kind of like some sort of deep instinct. I started out doing physics as a degree and then became interested in Chinese philosophy and qigong, tai chi, as you may be familiar with, and then really was almost overnight, having spoke to a friend, that I wanted to try acupuncture just to see what it was like. I had a couple of treatments and was really amazed by how it made me feel. I didn't actually go for any particular health condition, but I felt a sense of lightness, and I can remember it to this day and thinking, oh, why did that happen? And that really kindled my interest. And before I knew it, I was enrolling on a course, and the rest is history, as they say.
Ian Appleyard, Research and Policy Manager at the British Acupuncture Council. Huge thanks indeed, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much.
Get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.